Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, April 25th, 2024. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined Community Marking History. Trail of Death Marker Gets New Signage in Decatur by Danette Beckett. Decatur. Located at the bottom of a hill off of Lakeshore Drive is a boulder marking the Potawatomi Trail of Death. Approximately 800 Potawatomi Indians passed here on September 26, 1838, during their forced march to Potawatomi Creek, Kansas, after being driven from their land in northern Indiana at gunpoint, the monument reads. Although the stone has been sitting on the hill south of Mueller Park and the Decatur Park District's office since 1994, few people knew about the monument, much less the story behind it, and the nearly 80 others marking the treacherous journey nearly 190 years ago. Community leaders, public officials, and members of the Potawatomi Trail of Death Association met on Wednesday afternoon to dedicate a direction sign and to honor the Native Americans who sacrificed their land and lives. Records indicate 42 people, 28 of them children, died during the trek. George Godfrey is the president of the Potawatomi Trail of Death Association. His grandmother's interest in the trail's history encouraged him to take part in its preservation. And knowing that I cross the Potawatomi Trail of Death every day on my way to work, he said, I began researching. The sign was erected Wednesday after the dedication. Markers were placed in various locations along the 660-mile trail. Some remain, while others need to be more visible. The association created the signage with the hopes of offering clearer direction to the Trail of Death markers. I have a number of these in my garage, Godfrey said. However, approval is needed for the signs to be displayed along state-patrolled highways. It's kind of like we are on sacred ground here, said State Representative Sue Shearer. They went right by here. House Resolution 170, which requested the Illinois Department of Transportation to erect a sign directing people to the Decatur marker, was adopted by state representatives last year. Like many Decatur residents, Sister Joanne Shulian wasn't aware of the monument, although it was placed in its spot 30 years ago. I don't know much at all, she said. As I asked different Decatur people, they didn't even know the monument was up here. Shulian said she wanted to do something about the lack of historical knowledge and contacted Shearer and other important figures to bring the signage to the Decatur site. Two signs are there, she said about the brown historical marker ahead signs. According to history, President Andrew Jackson signed into law the Indian Removal Act on May 28, 1830. 8 years later, Native Americans were forced to travel from Indiana, crossing the Mississippi River, to unsettled land in Kansas. The trek passed through Decatur on what was later called the Trail of Death. Approximately 850 members of the Potawatomi tribe took the 660-mile trek. 3 weeks were spent traveling through Illinois during a drought before the group crossed the river in Quincy. Several would die along the journey. According to Mark Sorensen, former president of the Illinois State Historical Society, information about the locations was recorded by the militia leaders, including the distance traveled, the topography, weather, and the almost daily deaths during that drought-stricken summer and fall, he said. Dozens of Potawatomi died in the heat while going across Illinois. The Potawatomi Trail of Death Association has several statistics, including information of the trail's 76 historical markers. The Decatur Monument has a quote from Father Benjamin Marie Petit, a missionary to the Native Americans in Indiana who traveled with the Potawatomi. We soon found ourselves on the Grand Prairies of Illinois, under burning sun and without shade, from one camp to another. Petit is quoted on the Decatur Monument. Other oral stories have followed along the trail. Little by little, we pick up bits and pieces of information, Godfrey said. Local members of the Daughters of the American Revolution, Boy and Girl Scouts, local historical societies, and Potawatomi relatives contributed to the dedication of other historical markers as well. Shirley and Bill Willard's sons were Boy Scouts in Rochester, Indiana, where the Trail of Death began. They were encouraged to become members of the Potawatomi Trail of Death Association. The couple traveled to Decatur to be a part of the sign dedication. We travel every 5 years as a caravan, stopping at just about every place that the Potawatomi stopped in the 1838 journey, Shirley Willard said. We've dedicated historical markers. We've reached out to the public to let them know about the Trail of Death, because not too many people knew about it. This article is accompanied by two photographs. The first, in full color, is attributed to Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, and is captioned, Decatur Park District Executive Director Clay Gerhard and State Representative Sue Scherer help install a new sign marking the Potawatomi Trail of Death after a ceremony Wednesday at Muller Park in Decatur. The second, also attributed to Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, is a black and white photo, captioned, Ceremony attendees approach the stone marker for the Potawatomi Trail of Death, which passed through the area in 1838, at Muller Park with Lakeshore Drive in the background, in Decatur on Wednesday. Decatur Public Schools. Four more buildings passed structural tests. Dennis Lab School campuses still have final tests. By Tony Reed. Decatur. Four Decatur public school buildings easily passed the latest round in a rolling program of structural inspections, but the class problem children, the twin Dennis Lab School campuses, still have to sit their final exams. Those campuses were shut down last summer because of structural concerns, and the kids shifted to the former Garfield School, bolstered by the addition of modular classrooms to keep all the students together. The specialist firm testing all 25 structures in the school district, ranging from schools to the Kyle Administration Headquarters building, presented reports to the school board meeting Tuesday night on Baum Elementary, Montessori Academy for Peace, Muffley Elementary, and South Shores Elementary. Some 11 school buildings are still to be looked at, and Kyle Hannell, a structural engineer and project manager for Klingner & Associates, which is doing the work, said the results for the more than century-old Dennis buildings should be ready around May 28th. Kent Metzger, director of buildings and grounds for the school district, told the Herald & Review Tuesday evening, that will probably be the most intense report. And while the school board he serves has still to make a decision about the permanent future home for Dennis, it doesn't have to worry about the futures of Baum, the Montessori Academy, Muffley, and South Shores. Hannell said Baum, built mostly in 1975, and the Montessori Academy, built mostly in 1966, got solid passing grades with no major repairs needed. They just required brushing up on areas like tuck pointing and minor roof repairs. Muffley, largely dating from 1956, and South Shores, most of which was also built in 56, scored lower, but still passed. Muffley has a leaning exterior retaining wall that needs remedial help, while South Shores has one joist-bearing masonry wall that could use improvement. And both schools need minor upgrades like tuck pointing and small roof repairs. Roofing math. School board member Mark Reynolds wondered about the priority system surrounding roof repairs, and Metzger said it was a daunting math problem. We have 1.7 million square feet of roof, he said, of the entire school district. And so it's a very significant impact on the budget. We've been doing about $2.5 to $3 million of roof work per year. He said the current building survey would provide useful guidance to help the district come up with a lesson plan that will determine which priority repairs need to be tackled first. Reynolds also wondered how long the school board can expect its school buildings to last and pondered what the life expectancy should be, 80 years, 90 years, or whatever. Hannell, the structural engineer, said their useful academic life all depends on how well they were built in the first place and how well they've been looked after since. The four buildings I presented on tonight, they still have really good guts to them, he told the board. Buildings can go for a long time if you keep up on the maintenance. Board President Bill Clevenger said he would like to see a rolling facility management plan developed to guide this board and future boards on looming maintenance issues. That would be a goal and something we definitely want to take on, Metzger told him. In other business, the board is edging closer to making a decision on a plan that will equip school campuses with solar panels to provide 100% of their power needs. A survey by an outside contractor has been completed, showing the number and placement of panels required to get the job done. The school district's chief operating officer, Mike Curry, said all that remains is sending the project out for bids, a decision that could be taken at the next board meeting if board members feel ready to charge ahead. Dimming scores. The potentially bright future for the school district of self-powered and well-maintained buildings isn't without a few sunspots, however. A presentation at Tuesday's meeting of district-wide test scores for students of all ages in those buildings made for gloomy reading, with results in key areas of math and reading generally lower in all grades, and particularly dire for the youngest kids. Citing an issue that is likely to come in for some intense scrutiny in the near future, Clevenger said the raw numbers were a call to action. We can talk all day, but I think we are way past the time for talk, he told the board. Clevenger said improvements are going to take time, but the work must begin now. This is really the future of Decatur. It's our future workforce. It's our future leaders, he added. And if those scores in the elementary years reflect where we are, we've really got some work to do. So I think the time is now. Not tomorrow, but now. Rare whooping crane rescued in Chicago area with costume, fruit. Bird, one of only 75 in the eastern migratory population. By Barry Adams. A young whooping crane took an unlikely route home this week, thanks to a conspiracy that involved a costumed researcher, green grapes, and alert bird watchers, concerned about the crane's safety amid the heavy traffic of suburban Chicago. Within hours, Bird 16-23, hatched at the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, was back home Tuesday in the much more bird-friendly environment of Horican Marsh, where it learned to fly last fall. The female crane had spent its winter in west central Indiana, but at some point during this spring's migration north, became separated from its group of four other cranes. Online bird forums lit up Tuesday in the Chicago area about the whooping crane's presence, which ultimately drew the attention of the International Crane Foundation. The bird, referred to as Animal during its days at ICF, was first spotted along the Lake Michigan shoreline, and then, a short time later, flew inland to the northern suburb of Wilmette, where it was spotted walking across a residential street. The crane is one of just 850 whooping cranes in North America and one of only 75 in the eastern migratory population. The ICF could have left the bird alone, hoping it would depart and make its way to Horican on its own. But because of concerns over the bird's safety in the urban environment, and considering the relatively short drive from Baraboo, the decision was made to try and capture the whooping crane and give it a ride back to Wisconsin, according to Ann Lacey, director of the ICF's Eastern Flyway Programs in North America. We had to weigh all of the odds, Lacey said Wednesday. This is a young bird. It's obviously already lost, and it's close enough that it's a day trip for us to come down. Founded in 1973, the ICF is headquartered on a sprawling 240-acre campus that includes exhibits of cranes from around the world, including a pair of whooping cranes, one of the rarest birds in the world. The ICF was instrumental in helping to establish whooping cranes in the eastern U.S. The work, which began in 2001 and partnered with wildlife organizations and government agencies, included rearing young cranes with handlers dressed in crane costumes and migrations led by ultralight aircrafts. That history became critical to Tuesday's successful mission in Illinois. Armed with a baggie of green grapes, a favorite snack of Crane's, and a costume with a whooping crane puppet head. Hillary Thompson, who has helped rear whooping cranes for over a decade, made the drive to Wilmette along with ICF North American fellow Alicia Ward. Thompson donned the costume, slowly approached the bird, and began using the beak of the puppet head to toss grapes towards the wayward crane. Crowds were kept away, and dog walkers were detoured, and lawn maintenance was momentarily halted with help of Illinois wildlife officials. As Thompson inched closer, the crane recognized the puppet head from its days at ICF, which allowed Thompson to eventually reach out and slowly wrap her arms around the young crane. The costume disguises the human form, and she recognized the puppet head. It was something she recognized and was not freaked out about, Lacey said. By being calm and slow, Hillary was able to approach her. You can't rush it, because then the bird might flip out, and that could lead to a hurt bird. And so, by doing it calm and slow, she was able to get it in hand. Once secured, a hood was placed over the crane's head to keep it calm. A nearby veterinarian also examined the bird and signed off on a certificate of health to bring the bird back into Wisconsin. The bird was ultimately placed in a cardboard box from U-Haul, placed in an ICF van, and driven to Horican Marsh, where it was released as dusk approached. Getting to witness the rescue of a lost and seemingly exhausted young federally endangered whooping crane from a residential front yard in Wilmette today was beyond incredible, said Scott Judd, who photographed the crane's capture and is a member of the Chicago Ornithological Society. A truly memorable afternoon in Wilmette. The crane, which previously had an identification tag on its upper left leg, now also has a white GPS unit with a solar charger attached to its upper right leg, which will allow ICF researchers to keep close tabs on the bird for around 3 years. It's yet to be known if the crane will remain in the 32,000-acre cattail marsh or move on to another location. It could have gone wrong in so many ways, but it didn't. And a lot of it was luck, Lacey said. A lot of people came together to help, including the birding community that is infatuated with whooping cranes. It takes a village to save a crane. We're just so grateful that people are aware of this. Conditional discharge for man and hammer attack by Tony Reed, Decatur. The Decatur man who tried to persuade his ex-girlfriend to leave by repeatedly hitting her car with a sledgehammer while she was sitting in it, has been sentenced to a 12-month conditional discharge. Police had described the 54-year-old victim as being left with some 14 bleeding lacerations caused by flying glass when the hammer went through her car's windshield. The woman is quoted in an affidavit filed by Decatur Police Department Officer Griffin Meeker as saying former boyfriend Michael A. Wilt Jr. had ordered her to leave the driveway of his home in the 1500 block of North College Street on the night of September 20th. But the terrified woman also said her car wouldn't start after Wilt, 51, whom she dated for a year, had earlier rammed it with his own vehicle. The ex-girlfriend told DPD officers that Michael then threw a 5-gallon bucket into a window of her car that was filled with a black liquid, said Meeker. She told DPD officers that this black liquid got all over the inside of her vehicle. Police said Wilt counterclaimed that his ex-girlfriend had tried to ram him with her car, and he had wielded the hammer to defend himself. But the victim's version of events was backed up by a 58-year-old female witness who was a passenger in the victim's vehicle during the incident. Wilt's case had been scheduled for an April 15th trial in Macon County Circuit Court on multiple domestic battery charges. But the defendant had appeared in court April 2nd and taken a plea deal that saw him admit one charge of domestic battery causing bodily harm. Judge Rodney Forbes then dismissed two further domestic battery charges. Wilt had also been sentenced to 2 days in the Macon County Jail, but that was canceled out with 2 days credit for time already served, with the defendant also qualifying for a good behavior credit. Macon County Courts. Man who rammed cops gets 2 years by Tony Reed, Decatur. Jackie T. O'Neill, who rammed his way free of a police stop before fleeing at high speed, while his teenage female passenger allegedly tossed a submachine gun out the car window, has been parked in prison for 2 years. O'Neill, 20, pleaded guilty in Macon County Circuit Court to the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. The plea was part of a deal negotiated by defense attorney Courtney Anderson that saw Judge Rodney Forbes agree to dismiss a Class X felony charge of armed violence. The judge also dismissed 2 counts of aggravated fleeing and a charge of possession of a firearm while FOIA card revoked. A sworn affidavit said members of the Decatur Police Department's Community Action Team, which targets gun crimes, encountered O'Neill on the afternoon of January 29th when they tried to pull his Ford Fusion car over for a traffic stop in the 300 block of West Grand Avenue. The driver of the Ford then put the vehicle in reverse and struck our squad car, which was directly behind the Ford, said Officer Salvatore Ruiz, who signed the affidavit. The Ford then accelerated out of a parking lot and drove eastbound on Grand Avenue at a high rate of speed. Ruiz said those speeds hit 65 miles per hour on city streets before O'Neill lost control and plowed into a fence in the 1200 block of East Garfield Avenue. The defendant had tried continuing to flee on foot, but was chased down and arrested. The cops also took Denaja A. Weaver, 18, into custody at the scene and accused her of tossing a Glock 40 caliber handgun out the car window during the chase. Ruiz said the gun was fitted with an extended magazine and modified to make it fully automatic. Weaver is free on pretrial release and due back in court for a pretrial hearing May 1st. O'Neill appeared in court for his sentencing April 5th. Judge Forbes also sentenced him to an additional 2 months in prison after the defendant pleaded guilty to the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon in an unrelated case. But Forbes ordered that short sentence to run concurrent with the 2-year prison term. Festival of Spring set for Saturday by Danette Beckett, Decatur. The Macon County Conservation District will be hosting the 43rd Annual Festival of Spring on Saturday, April 27th. The event will be held at Rock Springs Conservation Area, 3939 Nearing Lane, Decatur. The day will begin with a bird banding presentation from 8 to 10 a.m. There will be a Sangamon River cleanup from 10 a.m. to noon. Registration begins at 9:30 a.m., and a shuttle will transport participants to the site. Groups should call 217-423-7708 in advance to assist with planning. Rock Springs will host a variety of free activities from noon to 4 p.m., including a Birds of Prey show and games. Canoes will be available for $3 per person. For more information, go to MaconCountyConservation.org. Documents can now be notarized online by Alex Ebeduto, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. Illinoisans who need a notary public can now access those services online through a new e-notary portal launched by the Secretary of State's office. This process is one of the latest initiatives of Secretary of State Alexei Janulius's ongoing effort to modernize the office and its services. Notaries are state-appointed officials who administer oaths, certify documents, and act as witnesses to document signings for things like affidavits and bills of sale. Until now, notary services could be performed remotely so long as the parties involved were in Illinois and the notary physically signed and sealed the notarized document. Now, the process can occur fully online through one of 12 notarization service providers listed on the Illinois Secretary of State's website, ilsos.gov. All parties can now participate remotely, and notaries are allowed to use electronic signatures and seals. Individuals using e-notary services must have a valid ID and access to a device supporting audio-video communication. The office is also in the process of moving other functions online, including by creating an electronic lien and title system, allowing drivers to manage vehicle titles online instead of through the mail. That system is slated for rollout this summer, according to a modernization report published by the Secretary of State's office last week. Illinoisans can already file incorporation and court of claims documents, access business service and lobbyist databases, search for jobs, and locate archived records through the office's updated website. The office rolled out Skip the Line and Do It Online initiatives last year in an effort to unclog DMV services by extending facility hours and online services and allowing Illinoisans to schedule appointments online. More than 1.5 million appointments have been scheduled since the Skip the Line initiative was rolled out last fall, according to the state's modernization report. The state has also opened 4 senior-only facilities in Bridgeview, Calumet Park, Evanston, and Westchester. The office is also going to start rolling out kiosks that would allow Illinoisans to renew their licenses, IDs, and vehicle registrations at various community institutions like libraries and grocery stores. Janulia said they will start with 10 locations, including one on the second floor of the state capitol, and hopefully expand to 150 within a year. The report also indicates the office is cross-training over 2,000 DMV staff on all offered services to minimize the number of different people a customer might need to speak to during a visit. Birthdays for April 25th. Actor Al Pacino is 84. Bassist Stu Cook of Creedence Clearwater Revisited is 79. Talia Shire is 79. Singer Bjorn Ulvaeus of ABBA is 79. Actor Jeffrey DeMunn, The Green Mile, is 77. Country singer-songwriter Rob Crosby is 70. Actor Hank Azaria is 60. Singer Andy Bell of Erasure is 60. Bassist Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction is 59. Guitarist Rory Feek of Joey and Rory is 59. Former early show host Jane Clayson is 57. Actor Gina Torres, I Think I Love My Wife, is 55. Actor Renee Zellweger is 55. Actor Jason Lee, My Name is Earl, is 54. Actor Jason Wiles, Third Watch, is 54. Actor Emily Burgle, Southland, is 49. Police shooting. The family of Dexter Reed, 26, a Chicago man killed March 21st when plainclothes police officers fired their guns nearly 100 times during a traffic stop, filed a wrongful death lawsuit Wednesday, accusing the department of brutally violent tactics. Aircraft maker. Boeing said Wednesday it lost $355 million on falling revenue in the first quarter, a sign of the crisis gripping the aircraft manufacturer as it faces scrutiny over the safety of its planes and whistleblowers' accusations of shoddy work. Bird flu. Dairy cattle moving between states must be tested for the bird flu virus, U.S. agriculture officials said Wednesday as they tried to track and control the growing outbreak. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, April 25th, 2024. Please stay tuned.